Susanna Hislop. It offers a selection of the myths and narratives that lie behind how the constellations got their names. As well as figures from ancient legends, there are some more modern objects enshrined in the sky, including the scientific instruments that were first used by astronomers to map the darkness. It's with one of these, given as a gift, that we begin today's episode.
Telescopium, the telescope. It's freezing and I've been standing here for ages. Even though this is my present, you gave it to me, you seem already to have commandeered it. Hang on, I think I've got it now. You fiddle with one of the lenses again, unscrewing something and attaching an indeterminate piece of plastic in its place. I shift my weight onto the other foot and bury my hands further down into my pockets. It's astounding how clear the stars are, here in the east of this polluted city, under a cloudless Monday night. It's still just completely out of focus. You're getting grumpy now. I don't try, as I did unsuccessfully about 10 minutes ago, to intervene. When Galileo's contemporaries first looked through his telescope, many of them denied that they could see anything at all. Perhaps they weren't lying. Perhaps the clergy objected to the wobbly, tunnel-visioned instrument, not because it supported the revolutionary assertions of Copernicus and Kepler and challenged religious hegemony, but rather because it was so annoying to use. Oh my God! You are leaping about, whooping. Finally, you let me look. And there it is. The moon. The moon, that until this very moment has been to me a vast and empty metaphor. The moon that is cratered in white and grey and moving so fast that I actually see it journey across the lens and vanish out of sight. The moon that men have stepped on, but which until now made no sense to me. The moon that I never really believed in, that I now witness orbiting the Earth. You show me the moon. This is no symbol, but the greatest expression of love.
Libra, the scales. Are you a Libra? Balanced, just and diplomatic? Born into the sign of the zodiac associated with the scales since ancient times? Perhaps because 2,000 years ago, the sun passing into Libra marked the September equinox, when day and night were equal. In the medieval world, astrology was synonymous with astronomy and a sophisticated and highly respected science. A horoscope was not something you leafed to guiltily over your special K, but a meticulously drawn astrological chart revealing the political significance of planetary configurations observed to the degree and minute using elaborate instruments called astrolabes and quadrants. Horoscopes may have their roots in personal predictions, ancient examples of which survive from 5th century BC Babylonia and Egypt. But by the time the 12th century scholar Adelard of Bath introduced the first accurate astronomical tables to the West, horoscopes were a far more sophisticated affair. The Greeks had developed the ancient art, thrown in a bit of philosophy, and passed it on to the Arab world, where it assimilated Indian, Persian, and Islamic traditions. So that when medieval English scholars travelled to Spain, Sicily and the Middle East, they brought home a vast body of scientific work, including astrological, alchemical and magical texts. Of the five key planetary aspects, that is, angular relationships between celestial configurations, medieval astrologers saw particular significance in conjunction, the appearance of planets on the same degrees of longitude. Conjunction foretold of major historical happenings, of religious and political upheaval. So when it became apparent that in September 1186, all of the seven then known planets, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, the Sun, Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn, would conjoin in the sign of Libra, astrologers had a predictive field day. The English chronicler, Roger of Hoveden, catalogued the panic. Since Libra was classified as an airy sign, there were widespread fears of violent storms and winds. Astrologers, like Coram Fiza, warned of blackened air polluted with the stink of poisonous vapours. Many people will be seized by death and sickness, and loud noises and voices will be heard in the air, terrifying the souls of those who are listening. As the day approached, alarm spread. But luckily, and as so often disappointingly with even the most hopeful of horoscopes from Mystic Meg, reality bore only a passing resemblance to prophecy. Nothing more impressive occurred than the eternally British scenario of some hail in Kent and some floods in Wales.
Leo Minor, the Lion Cub. She had fallen in love with astronomy before she could remember. When still a little girl, Katharina Elisabetta Koopman crossed the streets of her native Danzig with her parents, rich merchants able to fulfil their daughter's fantasies, and knocked on an astronomer's door. Showing her the delights of his world-famous observatory, Johannes Hevelius promised to unveil to her, when of course she was old enough to understand, the mysteries of the night sky. Elisabetta passed through the years with impatience. Finally, when she was 15, she knocked on his door again. 36 years her senior, this proud lion of the astronomical world, gave a broad grin. Hevelius' first wife, who had not shared his passion for the stars, but preferred to nag him about the finances of the family brewery he was forced to run, had just died. We will never know at what exact point after Elisabetta stepped over his threshold, the consummate mathematician put two and two together, but years later he recalled their union with great sentiment. She exclaimed with enthusiasm, "To remain and gaze here always, to be allowed to explore and proclaim with you the wonder of the heavens, that would make me perfectly happy." And the worthy man felt that it might make him happy, too. As a woman, she would not be allowed to attend university, and the only way to pursue a scientific career would be through an expedient marriage. Perhaps in Elisabetta's case, however, opportunity found itself intermingled with passion. A Polish Dorothea, whose heart jumped at this ageing man's erudition, she longed, with an ardour rivalling even that of George Eliot's zealous heroine, to commit her youth and beauty to his magnum opus. And for his part, Hevelius was no unaffectionate tyrant. When his young wife fell ill with smallpox, he never left her bedside. Johannes died before the star atlas that he had been working on, with the considerable aid of his wife, was finished. It was edited and published by Elisabetta in 1690 and includes the insignificant and often ignored Leo Minor. Mrs. Johannes Hevelius, whom Françoise Arago called the first woman, to my knowledge, who was not frightened to face the fatigue of making astronomical observations and calculations, is considered the first female astronomer. A minor planet, 12625 Koopman, has been named in her honour.
Dorado, the goldfish. The goldfish in the sky is not a memory-poor, bowl-crazed domestic pet of the sort you win at a fun fair, but rather a Hawaiian mahi-mahi. Rafe End, the Dorado as the Portuguese named it, flashes gold, blue, and green on the surface of the sea. When caught and exposed to the air on a trawler's stinking deck, it changes color. Its bright hues fading with its life until finally it dies a muted yellow-gray. Like the European navigators who first spotted this exotic fish in the tropical and subtropical waters of the Indian, Atlantic, and Pacific Oceans, it is a highly migratory species and can be found exploring the coasts of the Caribbean, Costa Rica, Africa, Mexico, China, and many others in between. Placed in the southern stars by those same voyagers, Dorado is relatively faint and undramatic to the naked eye. However, just as the toucan, another of Keyser and de Houtman's celestial menagerie, reveals a wealth of treasures when seen through a telescope, so too this unassuming constellation is home to some extraordinary deep space objects. Most famous is the large Magellanic Cloud. Its partner, the small Magellanic Cloud, is in Tucana. 20 times as wide as the moon and with a diameter of 20,000 light years, the LMC is the largest satellite galaxy of the Milky Way. You can easily see the faint cloud floating in the night sky without the aid of any astronomical instruments, but when magnified, even just through a pair of binoculars, it transforms into a broad and astonishing bar of stars. A powerful telescope further reveals a cornucopia of nebulae and star clusters in this gas and dust-rich galaxy. Elsewhere, in the depths of this very unordinary goldfish, is the thrillingly named Tarantula Nebula. This star-forming region has long, spindly tendrils of gas like a spider's legs, but at 1,000 light-years across, would not fit quite so neatly behind your skirting board. At the heart of this stellar arachnid is a dense and massive cluster of 1 to 2 million-year-old blue stars, pumping out ultraviolet rays, much as its earthly counterpart pumps out venom to poison its prey. And right at the center of this, amongst a tight knot of stars, is R136A1. 10 million times brighter than the sun and 265 times as heavy, this is the biggest star known to humankind.
Jessica Gunning, Paul Copley, Maggie Steed and Coleman Domingo were reading from Stories in the Stars by Susanna Hislop. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. The news is next, and then Jenny Murray and Jane Garvey will be coming together for a Christmas extravaganza with Kirsty Young, Adil Ray, Charles Collingwood and the Reverend Rose Hudson-Wilkin. That's all in Woman's Hour in a couple of minutes.
The strike itself will be over on Tuesday and there'll be a discipline vote.
No!
On the day that secret government files from the mid-1980s are opened for the first time, Martha Carney will be joined in the studio by Roy Hattersley and Michael Heseltine.
We'll find out what was really happening behind the scenes in Margaret Thatcher's cabinet.
The Defence Secretary, Mr. Michael Heseltine, has resigned from the cabinet. He made the announcement to reporters as he stepped out of number 10
UK Downing Confidential
Street,
on BBC Radio 4, next Tuesday morning at 11 and then on the Radio 4 website.